Hey there. Welcome to Cageless, a conversation podcast about experiential wisdom and personal hope. I'm Jenny Johnson. I'm a writer, and I'm asking experts, thought leaders, and my friends to share their knowledge and tools on how they found freedom. Welcome to season one. Today, dare I say, we have my favorite guest thus far. We haven't even started the interview, but I already know it's going to be my favorite guest. She is one of those people whom you can just feel their soul, like, right up front, like, right when you meet them. She's a dangerous combination of smart and funny. This is Miss Christine Carmella. Hi.
Hi, Jenny. That was obscenely kind. I can't imagine I'll live up to those expectations, but I'll run with it, and I'll put that in my ego piggy bank for the next
two to three business years. Yeah. So Christine and I have been friends for a hot second. We have her alma mater, and I also went to school there. But we were ships in the night. We didn't like graduate together, or even like really connect until after we parted ways. Christine is a writer, an actress, probably one of the best looking people that I've seen up close, like in real life. Christine, why don't you give us a little bit about you.
Okay.
Where are you from?
Okay. So I was born in Philadelphia, and so I'm a patriot, at least as much as I can be as a trans woman of color in this country. And I was born there, was there for a year. And then I said, get me out of here. So I moved to Las Vegas. And then I spent my entire childhood there. So that was interesting. And then went to college, my undergrad in Texas, in Fort Worth, Texas. Big jump. And then moved to New York right after that. Big jump. And then moved to LA after that to go to grad school. Big jump.
And how old are you?
That's no one's business.
You have not even lived three decades, and you have lived in a handful of states.
I tell people I'm 21.
Yeah. Age is a construct, but you have a lot of wisdom already.
Maybe so.
Okay, so you moved to New York after you graduate.
That's true.
And it was just such a short stint.
It was.
Why did you leave?
I moved to LA because I am attending grad school at USC in their screenwriting program. And I was considering staying in New York. And then after some conversations with some writing mentors of mine and a lot of reflection and deep thought, I stumbled upon the realization that USC was the correct choice, at least for this era.
Era, yes.
I strictly define my life in eras. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Like, I literally have a note on my phone with each era from like month year to month year.
Yeah.
I define them by albums. It's a very insane thing I do, but it's great for my compartmentalization.
Yes.
And great for my like tracking of personal nonsense.
Right.
So I started this current era in the spring of last year. Yeah, and I'm still in it. Haven't defined it yet. Haven't defined the album. I feel like that's usually only something I can do in retrospect or very late in the era.
Right. They say like not to name the book until you've written it.
Exactly.
Right. So what was the prior era to now?
Let me look it up. I'm pretty sure I know what it is. And it's controversial.
Tell me that these are Taylor Swift albums.
The last one is a Taylor Swift album.
Girl After My Own Heart. Honestly.
Actually, yeah. The last one was my lover era, I fear. So here's the gag. So I went through my Reputation era.
Terrifying.
Horrifying. Truly horrifying. From like March of 2019 through March-ish of 2020.
Exile. Jail.
Jail. Chaos. It was a horrible era. I was very controversial. I was talking a lot of shit. Having a lot of big time mental transitions and quandaries that I had to face.
Absolutely.
And then I entered my lover era, which was, I think, a shift for me in a lot of ways. Not for like superficial, there's a lot there. Anyway,
a lot there.
It wasn't my best era, as lover was not Miss Swift's best work at all.
Hot take.
Bottom tier work for her, frankly. Mm. And I'm not even a Swiftie. And it was a mild comeback. It was a real return to roots. Mm-hmm. Not all hits, and there was some mild controversies, but you know.
But it was rainbows. It wasn't dark doom and gloom.
It was on the come up thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I mean, shocking that you didn't do 1989 because Welcome to New York.
Yeah,
but Ta-Ta New York, act ta-ta, in reality,
I fear.
And Hello Los Angeles.
Yeah.
How are you liking Los Angeles right now?
Well, I really didn't like it when I first got here. Really did not care for her.
Mm.
But now I'm in a tolerant relationship with her.
Mm.
I really like what I'm doing here, if that helps. Like, I really enjoy my school and I really enjoy the people I know here and the friends I have here and the opportunities I've been able to have here.
Absolutely.
The city itself, it's slowly growing on me. I don't want to say I don't like it because I hated New York at first, but then I became obsessed with it.
Right.
So.
Well, also the thing is if you can do New York, you can do anywhere. You are one of God's strongest soldiers.
I'll take it.
Okay. So in my show notes, I am really just curious. Mm-hmm. What was your first reaction when I asked you to come on Cageless?
I was excited. I genuinely was.
Excited.
Because I feel like you are one of those people. I was talking to one of my friends about you the other day, and I was like, she's someone that I can sit down with, and I know within 5 minutes we're going to be talking about something deeply existential. And that can be really fun.
Well, I mean, like, I do. I love to dig, which is ironic because it's called Cageless, and it's about flying and birds. I'm wearing, no one can see, but I'm wearing birds on my, crying birds on my shirt today.
Wow.
But I do, when I think of you, I think of someone who has broken the mold, broken the nest, broken the cage open, not just for herself, but for a lot of different people. Christine, I met you as Chris.
Mm-hmm. That's
yes.
True.
So I would love to chat a little bit about kind of your journey with your body and your mind.
Well, you know, Chris, she's a girl that's still near and dear to my heart. I still to this day wear a necklace that says Chris on it. Mm. It's still a nickname that I use with my nearest and dearest.
Mm-hmm.
A name that I've had since, you know, birth.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, she is dead. which is fine, honestly. And there's a lot there in terms of, I think a lot of trans people feel the need to like literally kill off, murder, destroy any proof of their past self, which is, I'm sure that works just lovely for some people.
Right.
I'm sure that's beautiful and refreshing and necessary for some people, but it was never the path for me and it was never the thing that I needed. I think I just more so needed to make a peace with my past self and kind of understand why they did what they did, what their struggles were, how they impacted who I am today, how they impacted the people around me when I was at my lowest and most volatile.
Right.
Who, you know, Chris was and what she was about and why she was about that and how that person became the person I am now.
Building ground.
Sure. Did I have a longer coming of age than most? Yes. I mean, I didn't transition. Well, I didn't start formally identifying as like a trans woman until 2019, which is honestly not that long ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Two years and change. It was October, I think, September, October of 2019 that I formally was like trans woman.
Yeah.
And before that, I was non-binary for several years. Mm-hmm. And then before that, I identified as a gay man, which none of that is true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was the original question? Let me circle back.
You know what? It doesn't matter. I loved the direction you steered us in, because it prompts my question of, did you ever feel, and I know that because you and I are friends, we've had conversations similar to this, but for our listeners, did you ever feel like there was a part of you that was like, it would be a lot easier for me to stay, a male, like identifying as a boy, like who you were assigned to as at birth, rather than like jumping out into like the abyss of like the unknown.
I for sure had that thought countless times, innumerable amount of times, truly. I came from a very religious environment. Like, I went to a very, very intense private Christian school throughout all of my middle school and high school experience. My parents were very religious. I mean, there was a phase where I was going to some kind of church or like small group or some religious activity, like, oof, one, two, three, four times a week. So it was
Boot camp.
boot camp, honey. I read that Bible front to back. Test me, babies. I dare you. So I did that, and that was obviously a lot. And then I decided I wanted to be an actor, and I went to my undergrad was for acting for the audience.
How old were you? Do you remember when you decide you're like, I'm gonna be an actor?
Very young, honestly.
Yeah. Performance heart.
Performance heart. I think it really, well, so I had a weird, so at first I wanted to be a pop star. I still want to be a pop star. That's ultimately the biggest
I
dream.
think that's a feasible dream.
Maybe. That was like the dream. And then because of that, I was like, where can I start singing? And then musical theater. And then I got into that gig. And then a few people were like, your voice is really weird. And I said, I don't know how to take that. I'm gonna myself. So then I started acting and not singing, and I developed a debilitating fear of singing in public. So there was that. And then I committed to acting and I really loved it. And yeah, I think it was maybe even summer after my junior year of high school, before my senior year, I was like, I think I'm gonna go to college for acting. I feel like that's the step for me.
Right, but and here's also the dealio.
Yeah.
You went, as you when did you identify as a gay man?
I started, okay, so I came out to myself at the time as a gay man in ninth grade.
And that's still like riddled with Christian culture.
Riddled, 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 riddled.
Right.
And I came out to like my
Deep in it.
first friends, my end of my sophomore year, I think. And then junior year, like a good group of my friends knew. And then senior year, pretty much everyone knew. And I was, we'll say, I'm going to say it. I was a trailblazer at my high school. There
Absolutely.
was a rule in the handbook that you couldn't come out at my school because it would be immoral and you would be expelled. And they'd expelled a previous queer children from their school, not even for doing anything necessarily wrong, but for simply declaring that they were queer. And I was, at the time, pretty good friends with like the lead pastor at the school. He taught my worldview class and my Bible class, and we got along fairly well in terms of he really respected me because I challenged a lot of his views and I would argue with him in the middle of ethics class. And so I was like, so there's a rule and I should technically be expelled and that's illegal and immoral and I could like sue you. And so, mind you, at the time when I did that, my parents didn't even know. So it was, I mean, a true bluff. But they changed the rule. And then after I left, there was truly like there was no other queer people in sight at my school. I did not meet another queer person until I got to college. And
And
so
you also went to a, for those who are listening that don't
I
know.
went to a Christian school. I went to TCU, Texas Christian. And so I had the rule changed. And then after I graduated, there was like a crop of gay kids that came up and queer kids. And I got messages on, like DMs for a few years. That was really touching for
Did it
me.
feel touching, or did it feel
So,
like you were kind of, you were the one who like kind of had to do the hard grunt work, like you had to go through it?
Well, here's a catchphrase that I have that I firmly believe in. I developed it in college because I had a similar experience with something that happened in my theater department. Being a trailblazer is only fun in retrospect. In the moment, it's usually quite miserable, but in retrospect, it's beautiful. It's a great story. People are like, wow, that must have been so cool. And it is cool in retrospect, but in the moment, it's horrifying and awful and
And
sad.
also, if I may insert, no one made you do any of this. This was like an internal resilience factor that kind of guided you a little bit. This is your personhood.
Yeah, I would say that it's not so much that I just chose to do it as so much as I didn't have a choice. Honestly, I couldn't sit. I just couldn't sit and be miserable and not speak up for like my own literal existence. Well, back to the original question of like transitioning and all that jazz and not feeling the pressure to stay identifying as male. One of the main reasons I didn't transition for so long was because in college, it became very clear to me and very aware to me that there were literally no opportunities for trans women and that people would still view me as a boy no matter what I did. Even when I started like transitioning and came out as non-binary and I used they, them for years, honestly, way before it even became like a common thing, which is a whole other trauma. I did not receive respect from my superiors in the theater industry. I was misgendered literally every single day by directors that I did professional shows with, mind you, that, in my bio, when I entered a cast, I was like, these are my pronouns and this is my identity. And people just didn't respect it. And by my teachers, and by the it was a lot for me. And so it was made very clear to me that if I were to transition, there would be no opportunities for me. And the only way to keep any sliver of opportunity that I could have possibly had was to stay identifying as a gay male and to, I mean, just play into the fantasy and the stereotype of like the high femme queer man. And the stereotype, and because I mean, there is a market for that, also a very small one, mind you. Told that it would just never work out. So even when I was identifying as non-binary, I definitely did some things and auditioned for some things that, oh, really hurt my spirit because they were things that didn't feel authentic to me or true to myself, and it tears you down slowly but surely,
And it's like,
and.
how do you sleep at night knowing that like the injustice that you're feeling, other people are probably feeling too, and you are aware that like you can do something about it, but it's going to be hard and it's going to hurt.
Completely, completely. And there's a moment that I will never forget. I realized the later half of my career at TCU in the theater department that I definitely made impact on the student body, on the
Absolutely.
even the school to a certain degree. Honestly, I hate to sound that way.
Oh no, I mean, I can co-sign.
and to like the faculty, and I had received a lot of comments and affirmations about that. However, all that was still consistently met with a fundamental disrespect of my identity, which was so eerie to me. And like at my final, our theater department has like a gala at the end of the year to celebrate the graduating seniors. And the chair of the department at the time introduced me and was like, this person has been a humongous culture shifter in this department and in this school. Huge impact, influential figure. Can't wait to see what happens next. Here he is.
How did that feel?
There was a snap in my brain, genuinely. I was still identifying as non-binary at that point. I was using they, she interchangeably. I literally hadn't been using he for years at that point. It was just crazy to me that even after all the progress that we'd in theory made and that I'd been placed as the poster child of, I still was not given the fundamental respect. And then furthermore, after I graduated, there was a freshman that came in who is a dear, she's a daughter of mine. She came in, she came out as trans like at the end of her first semester. It's after I graduated, and she reached out to me. I was the first person she came out to, which was a huge honor for me. And she'd only heard about me from the grapevine. And because I'd been like the poster child for queer change in the department, even though I had only been in a singular show at my school the entire 4 years I'd been there.
Which was beautiful, and I loved it.
Thank you. And in that show, I was a bit part. I was barely there. But nonetheless, I.
Memorable though.
Yeah. So this beautiful young girl came out to me, and she was really worried about how the department would take it. And I was like, I mean, yes, there are going to be struggles, but I think they've come a long way. And then I watched her tell me story after story about each teacher talking to her about me when all and treating her with respect and care. And, you know, she's struggling, but she's doing well in a generalish sense. And I felt real rage because I watched them treat her with the respect that they could never treat me.
Oh, that's honest.
I felt absolute rage. It was absolutely beautiful. I was so happy for her. I cannot emphasize that enough. But I was furious and it made me really angry. And I had to talk to my therapist about it extensively because I was boiling over.
Which, do you regret it? Do you regret being, do you regret all the like pain and trudging through all of those like, which I'm sure that you have countless stories of disrespect,
Yes, I
particularly when it comes to
do.
entertainment. I can't imagine.
Yes, I have countless stories. However, whether I regret it or not is honestly, it's super nuanced. And I can't quite describe it either way, honestly. I thought about it way too much.
Because if I may say, you also have a pretty large following on the internet. A lot of videos that you make, posts that you make have, I know a lot of them have brought a lot of liberation and a lot of laughs to me. So I can't imagine someone who does identify just a, I'm a straight cisgendered white woman. I'm like, oh my God, someone said it. Thank God. Like, thank God someone said this because we were all just thinking it.
Right. Yeah, that gets me in trouble a lot. even though people are thinking it, they don't want to hear it out loud.
No one ever wants to hear the truth, but someone's got to
No.
say it.
And I fear I just have too little of a filter to stop myself.
I don't ever want you to.
I'll try not to. But I used to always say that I was arrived just 3 years too early. Just like if I could have showed up a few years later, I would have had a violently different life. However, then someone pointed out to me, but who would have done it? You just would have had to do it 3 years later.
Who would have done it? The universe is never late.
Who would have done it? Who would have done it? Who would have spoken up like that? Who would have done those things? Who would have taken those steps? And that really hurt. But it really allowed myself to feel a certain amount of peace in terms of the stuff that I've had to deal with and the fact that I'd had to be for pretty much my entire life. And this sounds so lofty and irritating, as if I just carried the entire goddamn weight of the queer community on my shoulders. I did not.
Maybe you did a little bit.
I didn't. I didn't do that at all. But in my little microcosms of very specific and very, you know, personal spheres, I'd like to think, and I do genuinely at a certain point know that I did make some sense of a difference.
You did. And there, what's the saying of like, the sooner you're you, the sooner the people looking for you will find you. And I would counter that with the sooner you're you, the sooner the other people can be them.
Wow, I like that.
I do too. Should I coin that? I don't know. But
Maybe
you
you
inspire me.
should.
You inspire me to, as cliché as it sounds, all the clichés are true, to take up the space that I was given here. Well, also there, you know, there's the, I don't know if it's like, it's some sort of like spiritual practice saying of just like, if in terms of creativity, in terms of change, like if you don't do it, the universe, God, whatever entity you believe in, is going to find a channel for someone else to do it. You know what I mean? And hell hath no fury than someone doing something when I know that I'm capable of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Okay. Yeah. So pivoting a little bit into your work, as I mentioned, you are funny and smart and good looking, which is a scary, scary combination.
Don't post this video. They'll beg to differ.
Neither of us are wearing any type of like makeup today, which like screw that. Your writing, because I have been honored to be able to read and collaborate with you in the past, is equally as unapologetic as you are. In terms of your characters, in terms of your stories, how much do you believe in infiltrating liberation through those as well, rather than just writing for entertainment?
Okay. How much do I believe in inserting my own liberation into my own writing? That is a great question. I would say, so first and foremost, I think I've always identified as a comedy writer. And I think that a lot of people view comedy writers as not really saying much of intense value, and that in order to tell like meaningful, impactful, long-lasting stories, they need to be dramatic and have a real gusto and punch and vitriol to them. Is that the right word? Vitriol? Anyway, I don't think it is.
Yes, two writers. You know what? We'll be corrected. I promise you. We will be corrected.
Yeah, probably.
We get the gist.
We get the gist.
Yeah.
So I am a comedy writer and I write silly little movies about friendship, is what I always say. However, inherent to those movies are my experience, and that is that I am a, you know, trans bisexual woman of color, Latina specifically, and most of my friends are queer. Most of them are of color. Most of them come from wildly different backgrounds. I am very invested in comedy that comes from a real place in terms of queer people of color are the funniest people I know. There's also a lot of inherent trauma there, whether we're consciously aware of that in terms of the way we deliver jokes or not. And so I think they go hand in hand. I'm not here to develop trauma porn, though. My God, trauma porn is the worst thing on earth, and it makes me miserable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really exploitative. However, if we can show reality in a way that is also compelling and funny, that to me is what I want to do. I don't know about you, but
no, it absolutely did. I say all of the time, like, God's a comedy writer. Like, it gives us so much good material. Like, why would you not use real life whenever, if you can just like take yourself out of your own shoes for a second and you're like, hold on, this is f-ing funny. Like, this is funny right now.
Yeah.
And I, at least from a personal perspective, I don't like being spoon-fed Disney anymore. I don't like being spoon-fed stories that are fabricated and from a, you know, very stale, boring, privileged place from probably a white man's pen. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm just deeply uninterested, mostly because those narratives have harmed my mind's eye. And they have not been beneficial to my well-being. You know, we look at Cinderella, we look at Sleeping Beauty, we look at Snow White. And I'm just naming off princesses. You know, we can look at Dumbo, we can look at so many of the bedtime stories that we were told, and when you actually like sit there and dissect them, you're like, why are we telling children, like The Little Mermaid, for example? I listened to revisionist history about The Little Mermaid, and it is a sick story.
Oh, it's sick and twisted.
Oh my gosh, the body count in Tarzan, there's first of all so much death in that. Like, I am so much more interested in reading the stories from real life, just because like making things up where has it gotten us as a culture? Where has it gotten us in like terms of like shaming us into corners?
Okay. You know? It's a curious concept.
And I also think that I'm just so much more interested in and watching people that I know from day to day. As you mentioned, you're not surrounded with, you know, Troy Boltons. You're not surrounded with Rapunzels. You're surrounded with people that look real and act real and have real stories and real feelings.
Yeah. I'm surrounded by a bunch of people that have been relegated to side characters that very much so deserve to be main characters.
Yes. I think that you have the most main character energy, honestly. I know any of your friends and anyone who knows you in real life would also co-sign that. You're the life of the party, honestly.
God, Jenny.
Life of the party. Anytime I'm in a room with you, I just feel so much more energized. It's like, oh, thank goodness. Okay, so here's another question for you.
Okay.
What is the biggest thing that you feel like you have had to unlearn in your like adolescence? Because we can talk about wisdom all day, but what is wisdom other than the undoing of things that you wish you hadn't been taught?
I feel like I have spent most of my adult life desperately trying to unlearn most of what I developed and learned in my adolescence. Mm. Honestly and truly. I mean, the list is so long. Okay. I'm going to do like a top three, I think. So number one is that I think I went through an era where I believed I was truly a victim. And I think that was because of the way a lot of people had bullied me in my youth. And I realized that most people are coming from a place of absolute ignorance or just lack of understanding. I mean, in high school, I had this friend of mine, and I'm still friends with him. He used to bully me relentlessly. And then he became boyfriends with one of my good friends. And we slowly but surely started to become friends. And years later, in our adulthood, we were talking to some of his friends that he met in college. And people were asking how, you know, we became friends. I was like, it's actually really funny because he used to be one of my biggest bullies. And they were like, what? And even my friend was like, what do you mean I was one of your biggest bullies? And I was like, you used to tease me relentlessly. You called me horrible things. You said horrible things about me to my peers and to my face. And he was like, I guess I didn't realize. Like, he truly just didn't know at the time that what he was saying was harmful.
Right.
And I feel like that's the case for most things.
It's not even personal because, like, whatever their insecurity is, they're probably going to be projecting on you.
Whatever their insecurity is, they're going to be projecting. And honestly, so much of it is learned behavior. He came from a very Christian environment, so he saw me very different. And he didn't know any better but to point it out and ridicule it because that's what he'd been taught. It's so cyclical. It's scary. And I know
it almost takes like the inherent worth of the insult out of it. Yeah. It's kind of like, oh, like the core of my being isn't actually wrong.
Yeah.
Like it's just all of the wrong that's happened to you.
And once I realized that what people said I could choose to let it have no power over me, it, you know, changed my mindset. I've always been someone, you can ask my parents, I've always been a bitch to not let a know that they've hurt my feelings. I refuse. My parents tell me that when I was a kid and they would punish me, they would spank me, whatever, I would never cry. I would refuse to cry. I would simply turn around and look at them. Sometimes smile even.
Strength.
It just has never been in my nature, which I think is stubbornness and also led to a lot of personal issues in terms of being just closed off. And a friend of mine in college once told me that every time I think I've broken down the lost wall, I found another one. And that really hurt my feelings. However, it really brought a certain level of awareness to me. And he didn't mean it to be hurtful. However, it really opened my eyes to the way that I am, you know, going about and conversating with people that I consider my closest friends. That because I am so afraid of being hurt and so afraid of being the victim, that I have closed off all possible emotional availability and open frankness and beauty in the world, it makes you miserable. Because for as much incomparable bad in the world, there is an indiscernible amount of good.
Right.
And if you close yourself off so that way you can't feel any of the bad, you're not going to feel any of the good either.
That's not a way to live.
No, and this isn't a groundbreaking thought, but that's what I have to say on that.
No, absolutely. That's so good. So good.
And then another one I had to learn, this one was a later in life thing in my, I call it my womanhood adolescence, because I think one of the most jarring things about transitioning, at least from a male identifying to female identifying, is the rapidness at which you're suddenly sexualized.
Tell me about that. Tell me about that.
And so, I mean, I had mostly girlfriends, and so I'd heard so many stories and so many horrible, horrible things about girls. I think most girls have a moment to realize that they realize that people were viewing them as a sexual object.
And it's young.
And it's usually startlingly young,
Yeah.
like scarily young.
Yeah.
And I did not experience that till I was in college,
Right.
till I was like 20. And I didn't know what to do with it because I had guy friends who suddenly talked to me differently.
Right.
Once that shift happened and they viewed me
Yeah.
as little, Twinkie boy to thing I could f possibly,
Right.
there was a definitive shift in the way that they looked at me, talked to me, interacted with me, perceived me, and you could see it and you could
Yeah.
feel it. And it was horrifying to me. And
And what a dichotomy from going from male who did not think that way to female who was being objectified from males who
Yes.
did think that way.
And there was an additional layer to it in terms of I already felt this like disconnect from men as a whole because I thought they looked at me as like a freak or like someone different that I had to prove myself to them because of my
Yeah.
queerness. And then when I started transitioning, it was still there. I still knew that they still viewed me as definitely an other. As a commodity, as an
Right.
oddity, as a special attraction.
Yeah.
I thought that I had to get ahead of the joke and sexualize myself. I thought I needed to get, if I could sexualize me first, then they couldn't do it in a way that made me uncomfortable.
No, you beat him to the punch.
I beat them to the punch. And
Line.
furthermore, if I've made a lot of jokes about my identity, about the way I dressed, about the way I acted, about the way my makeup looked, about the way my hair looked, and they couldn't beat me to that punch either. So there comes a point when self-deprecation just becomes self-hatred.
Wow.
And that's what I did. I became a self-hating, self-imposed truly. Was I actually sleeping around? Not really. But did I make all my guy friends thinking that I was? Kinda.
Easy A.
Easy A. And it ended up hurting me
Yeah.
tremendously. Yeah, it was the internal misogyny. It was the internal transphobia. It was the internal homophobia. I mean, I was going by they, she at the time. I dated this guy briefly,
Right.
who I pretty much let go around and tell everyone that he was bi now, and that, it was so cool dating like a basically guy for the first time. And truly, the amount of self-hatred that that took, and he treated me so poorly, but it was the first time in my life, and I cannot emphasize that enough, the first time in my life that someone had ever pursued me at all. And that was enough, and I didn't know any better, and I was really grown at that point, really grown.
That internal misogyny never goes away.
But I still allowed it to happen because I didn't know any better. And so I describe it as like a second adolescence, which is a very common term in the queer community in terms of when you transition or come out, or sometimes even both, you go through kind of a second adolescence in which you kind of have to relearn everything that most people learn when they're like 13, 13 through 16, when they first start dating, when they first start, figuring things out about their sexuality, when they first start presenting themselves to the world. That's a whole other thing. The way my style had to evolve because of transitioning, and it's a very long journey. So sexualizing myself was a huge thing that I've had to unlearn, and just to be comfortable in who I am and set boundaries for myself. And I still do it, kind of, and I'm still actively working on it, but I refuse to make myself the butt of the joke anymore. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a funny joke. Funny jokes always have a place, but most of those jokes weren't funny. They were just mean and sad.
I think that's a thing that us as society can collectively begin to implement is, am I laughing because this is funny or is it because it's hurtful?
Yeah. We, as a society, love to talk. It's ingrained in our psyches. It's wonderful when you think it won't actually hurt anyone else. But then once you take a step back and realize that it's actively hurting people, like to a deep psychological level in the way that they view themselves in their everyday lives, it makes the joke a lot less funny.
A lot less funny. Okay. Wow. What great answers. So just though I do not want this conversation to end, you and I are known to talk for hours and hours until inappropriate hours. But last question for now until I have to have you back on. What out of all of this reflection of your remarkable journey thus far, what would you tell your younger self about freedom? What would you say to her today?
About freedom. Mm-hmm. If I could go back in time, I would go back in time and tell little Chris that whatever people are telling you to be or you think you have to be, you never have been, you never will be, and you never have to be. You're just never that. You've never been that one. And you're never going to be that one. And that makes you better. Mm. And stronger. And beautiful. And it's really hard. And it's really hard. And a lot of times it just gets continuously more hard. And sometimes it gets better. Sometimes, I usually hate that phrase, but mostly you get better.
Sizzling. Do you think she would listen?
No.
And that's what makes her Christine.
No, I don't think she'd listen at all.
She just keeps doing whatever she wants to do.
She's going to look me in the eye and say, you, you old hag. Get the away from me with your raggedy hair. Put a brush through that. Change your clothes. You look like a 30-year-old cosplaying as a 20-year-old. What the are you doing?
Oh, that's too good.
Start insulting me. I know she would. And you know what? I would start insulting her back.
And you would give it back. You would absolutely give it back. Like you give everything back. I don't know if you've ever played basketball, but you are wonderful at bouncing it back.
I have played basketball in my time on this stupid little earth.
You are kind of a supermodel, so you have the height.
I was bad at it. I really was horrible at it.
Do you want to hoop sometime? I play it ironically.
Define playing basketball ironically. What does that even entail?
So I was never athletic. I'm still not. Mm-hmm. I was on the juggling team.
There's a juggling team?
And where I'm from, absolutely. Was I also made fun of? That's another conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I started trying things that I knew I wasn't going to be good at. Like on Fridays this past summer, I started trying new hobbies. So I'm like, I know I'm not going to be athletic. I know I'm not going to be good at this. I'm going to go play for fun.
For sure.
Is it fun? Failing's only fun if you assign the meaning beforehand. But I will say we could play a game of horse.
Oh.
You come over.
I used to play horse.
Mmm.
This ain't my first time at the rodeo.
I hated that. I think I'm going to cut that out. That was awful.
You know what? I will play you in horse only if I can wear a skirt while doing it.
Ooh. She wears short skirts. I'll be in the bleachers, probably.
Yeah, no. I'll play it in like a sundress for maximum movement.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Wow. Christine, thank you for all of your time today. Thank you for your words.
Not even an hour.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate any time that I get to spend with you, whether it's through an internet screen or in real life. For our listeners who can find you.
That's so true. You could find me. You could hunt me down.
who can find you through a screen as well. Yeah, don't do that. She loves her space. How can we find you online? Where can we find your work? What is up?
Oh, wow. Where can you find my work? You know, that's actually horrifying because someone on TikTok told me they found one of my plays online. And I said, oh, God, no.
Those TikTokers. What is your TikTok?
Oh,
what
my is TikTok, your TikTok handle? Is at iChris, period, like the, you know, the period, teen.
The dot.
And that is also my Instagram. And my Twitter is iChris_teen because they don't allow periods in their usernames, which I find to be ridiculous, mean, hurtful, and first and foremost, transphobic.
Point blank period. Point underscore period.
If it's on Twitter, no points. No points. Just underscore.
No points. No points. So grateful. So grateful to know you, be known by you, to have you on Cageless.
It's been an honor to be on Cageless.
Absolutely. Great. Listeners, we love you. We want to hear from you.
Yeah.
And have a wonderful day.
Have a beautiful day.
Thanks, guys. If you enjoyed or learned anything from today's episode, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a text or call to 903-871-5092. It's completely free and anonymous if you choose. You can also shoot me an Instagram DM, that's in the show notes, or follow along with the Cageless newsletter. And don't forget to be kind to yourself today.